Hi, and welcome to Women Rule. I'm Carrie Budoff-Brown, editor of Politico. Today we're bringing you a bonus episode. We're letting Susan Glasser, host of our Global Politico podcast, take over. She's doing a two-part series on women in politics and the sexual harassment they've faced, and we're running the first part of that series. Stay tuned for that conversation. On the Women Rule podcast, we'll be bringing you backstage with women leaders, the big bosses in politics and policy. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter at @CBudoffBrown. Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. And now a word from our presenting sponsor, Chevron. When more girls go into science, technology, engineering, and math, the whole world benefits. With the support of families, schools, policymakers, and businesses, girls can do remarkable things with STEM. Chevron is proud to join Women Rule in empowering the next generation of female leaders. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Susan Glasser.
Hi, I'm Susan Glasser, the host of the Global Politico, and this week I'm delighted to be also guest hosting the Women Rule podcast. We have a very special two-part episode, a special report that we're bringing to you on the Global Politico and Women Rule about women in national security and the unique challenges and problems they face when it comes to sexual harassment and sexism in the workplace. We've been having a national conversation, obviously, in the weeks since these revelations have come out about Harvey Weinstein, about Fox News, and about all the many other workplaces, many of them in the media, but not exclusively so, where women have found themselves to be living with a kind of sexual harassment I think many people wanted to think we'd moved on from. I've been lucky enough and privileged enough to work alongside of women who help make our nation's national security policy, women who are involved in America's presence in the world for the last couple decades. And I have to tell you, it's a unique subculture, and it's one where women are uniquely disadvantaged in many ways. Not only are men absolutely dominant, but as you'll hear in this fascinating episode of Women Rule, it's a world where even our very definitions of what constitutes a national security professional are still very male. We convened six of the smartest, most experienced, and really wisest women I know to talk. They shared with us frank and, in times, shocking stories about what it's like to be a woman in national security. I thank them for doing this, and I thank all of you for listening. It's a very special episode of the Global Politico and Women Rule. I'm very lucky to be in the room with this fantastic group of women. First, we'll just go ahead and go around.
Lauren DeYoung-Shulman. I spent about 10 years working at the Department of Defense and National Security Council, both under the Bush and Obama administrations, and another few years since then working in the think tank world in national security.
Julie Smith. I served in the White House and the Pentagon in the Obama administration, first at the Pentagon as the principal director for Europe and NATO policy, and then at the White House as the vice president's deputy national security advisor.
Kathleen Hicks. I spent about 17 years in the Defense Department in both career and political positions ranging from the Clinton administration all the way through the Obama administration, culminating as the principal deputy undersecretary for policy.
I'm Laura Rosenberger. I served for 11 years in the State Department and the National Security Council at the White House, the vast majority of that time as a career official, part of that time sharing a closet with Lauren Shulman.
A very prestigious closet.
A very, very prestigious closet directly outside of the door of the National Security Advisor's office. I'll leave that there. After that, I served as Hillary Clinton's foreign policy advisor on her 2016 campaign.
I'm Mika Ouyang, and before I was in think tank land, I spent 12 years on the Hill. I served as a professional staff member on the House Armed Services Committee, a professional staff member on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and as the defense policy advisor to Senator Edward M. Kennedy of Massachusetts.
I'm Evelyn Farkas. I've worked in the national security field for about 30 years, including overseas in various think tanks, and then for about the last 20 years in Washington, almost equally divided between Congress, working for the Senate Armed Services Committee and a congressional commission, and then also for the Pentagon.
As you can see, I am very lucky and privileged to be surrounded by some really badass women. So I want to thank everybody for your time today. Seriously, it is a privilege. And, this is a group that is sort of convened informally in various settings. And I've already been enriched by the deep knowledge and understanding of things at which we journalists tend to only skim the surface on. But I feel like, we've all been experiencing, in a way, this national conversation that's erupted over sexual harassment in the workplace, both as observers and just readers and consumers of this information, but of course, also as women professionals. And then there's the third layer, which is the reason that we're here today, which is that we all know something that's very hard to communicate, but is really important. Women in national security, women in our foreign policy establishment here in Washington are a minority of a minority of a minority, and they face a very unique and specific set of challenges, which inevitably have come up when this group convenes in any kind of setting, formal or informal. And so then to layer on top of that, reading these stories of what are happening in workplaces around the country. Just the other day, the defense minister of Great Britain, was forced to resign at almost the exact same time as the chief editor for news here in Washington at NPR was resigning. What I thought is that it would be a shame in a way, not to convene this group and not to have this conversation about what it means here in Washington. We're facing a crisis, in my view, of women and power in Washington. We're all roughly peers, some a little older, some a little younger, but basically, we're all roughly peers around this table. And I think most of us would have been shocked when we came to Washington and graduated from college to find out that women had not made the progress that we anticipated. We were just talking about how this is the lowest number of women in the cabinet since Ronald Reagan, how there are been three women U.S. attorneys appointed and, dozens of men. Women were already very sparse in many of the very senior national security roles that all of you have served in. I think the main purpose, as I see it, of this conversation today is really both to let people in a little bit on your world. What has it been like to be a woman trying to assert women's place at the table as it belongs in our national security and foreign policy conversation? What is the nexus that we all perceive or maybe are reexamining between sexual harassment, sex, and sexism in the workplace here in Washington, this very unusual world that we've all inhabited? And what is our role as women leaders, both experiencing this in many cases, we can talk about our own personal experiences, and also experience this as colleagues, both to women who experience abuse, but also as leaders. So it's a big mandate. I thought we'd just go ahead and jump right in and sort of establish from the get-go where we're coming from personally on this. Julie, I thought we'd start with you. You wrote, it's not related to sexual harassment per se, but you wrote a piece recently, I think, that a lot of us were struck by about your own experiences trying to be a mom and just how isolating that was or how that caused you to look at life in the White House differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think you opened with an important point. Kind of the vision that many of us had when we entered the field of national security versus the vision we have of some of the challenges we face as women today, now that we've been in it for a while and we've developed our careers and tried on different hats and taken on different roles. And as I mentioned in that piece, I certainly entered the field thinking, well, I'm lucky and fortunate that so many women have come before me and they've blazed these trails. And I can give thanks that we've had a female Secretary of State and I've seen women in leadership roles sparingly. But I feel like, or I felt at the time, I'll have the privilege of ignoring my gender in my profession, and I'll be able to tuck that aside and focus on the mission and the substance and all the rest. And what I've come to learn is that I encountered it almost immediately, that there were differences, there were unique challenges that I faced as a woman getting my start in the field. And in fact, those differences haven't really washed away as I've assumed different roles and climbed the ladder, so to speak, but they're ever present. And that the self-doubt that sometimes accompanies that in terms of how do I cope with some of these challenges, whether it's blatant sexism or subtle kind of bias, and there's a whole range of issues that we could get into. I've found that, you know, I'm in my 40s now, and I'm the mother of two kids, and there are very real challenges each and every day that I faced in government, and I still face out of government, that pose real dilemmas. And I'm grateful for this group around the table and other women that I've been able to talk to, so that we can help blaze trails along the way and help find some solutions.
So tell us what it was like to try to get pregnant while your colleagues were sort of like, what the heck is this going on with this?
Well, I'm an old mom. That's no secret in the piece. I think it's pretty clear. People who know me, I married somewhat late in life, and I decided to try and have kids in my 40s. That's no easy task. Certainly for me, it wasn't, and I've been pretty honest about that. And I had to seek assistance, and it was a challenge to seek fertility assistance while I was working a fairly intense job at the Pentagon in a heavily male environment where people ask a lot of questions. Where are you going? Can I go with you? Can I walk with you down the hall? No, you can't. I'm carrying needles in my purse, and I don't want you to know that. Or I'm on a plane traveling halfway around the world, and I have to go to the back of the plane and hope that people don't notice that I've been in there for 45 minutes. So it was difficult, but it wasn't just difficult to get pregnant. It was difficult then to be a new mother for the first time in a very high-paced environment. And again, I had the good fortune of finding other moms in that environment that could offer tips and suggestions and advice, and I was lucky that I was working for a woman up the chain. Michelle Flournoy was the undersecretary at the time. So I give thanks that there were moments where I was able to get real assistance, but I also think we all need to be honest with women that aren't there yet, that will face some of those same challenges, and be honest about the mixed emotions and the ambivalence that sometimes we have. For me personally, I won't speak for everybody here, but I still to this day have real ambivalence about it. I want to spend time with my children. I want to succeed professionally. I tell myself every day, you can do both, Julie. But the reality is that I sometimes am driving home and thinking, you know what, you're kind of a fail on both sides. And you're not really acing it this week. You missed the Halloween parade, and you know, you also missed that important meeting at work. And so it's not, I think we like to all persuade ourselves that we can have it all. But we do find ways to have it all, but sometimes you have to just realize that you can't have it all at the same time, as many of us say.
You know, it's really interesting because I'm sure, like, we're a lot of head nodding around this table, and we could probably all share, you know, versions of this story of the balancing act. But I'm struck by reading all these stories. A lot of us, because I've talked to each of you guys individually, you know, it's you have these different phases of life, right? And so I think a lot of us were re-excavating, you know, re-evaluating what it was like to be a very young woman entering the world of Washington and encountering environments where there were older men who clearly saw us in a sexualized way and saw the workplace in a sexualized way. You know, I don't know, speaking for myself, right? Maybe now that we're so, you know, more advanced in age, it's a different set of challenges that have to do more with leadership. But why don't we talk about that a little bit? Like, you know, how much have all these revelations, you know, caused us to sort of like reevaluate, like, both what's happened, what happened to us when we were younger, and, you know, how we think the environment is for our younger colleagues now? Lauren, do you want to?
I remember starting at the Pentagon 10 years ago, and so many of the stories that we've heard about men saying wildly inappropriate things, or in my case, the special forces men kind of changing clothes in the middle of the office and walking around in their underwear, or talking about developing a calendar of sexy women in the office. I thought that was just a cost of doing business in the Pentagon when I was 24, 25 years old. And I remember my female colleagues and I, we sort of laughed about it uncomfortably, but we were never in a point where I think any of us said we should say something about this or we should do something about this. And the few times we ever did, we were effectively laughed out of the room, like, this is just what special forces guys are like. Come on, get over it. Like, you're lucky that they haven't done worse than that. And it's interesting, like, for the longest time, I had more or less ignored a lot of those kind of behaviors. And then the last, as you say, in the last year or so, as they come back to me, I think, wow, why on earth did I not say anything at that point in time to somebody who would actually have the authority and power to do something about it? And how many women were in a place that were my peers where something worse did happen to them, where, you know, it might have been a joke in my case where they were saying inappropriate things, but in others, how uncomfortable did they feel? Were they put in a position where they felt like they had to go on a date with one of these guys or be more inappropriate in the office than they otherwise might feel comfortable with? And that has been a kind of terrifying moment for me of, like, what did I accidentally walk by and what did I not report that I could have possibly prevented something in. But at the same time, though, I know in the Pentagon, in the environment that I was working in, it's entirely likely that people would not have done very much in a lot of cases. They might have wanted to, but the terror of having lawsuits, the terror of bringing any kind of human resources personnel into a given situation, and of creating a scene that may make it difficult for the office to operate, those dominated a lot of conversations whenever somebody did have the courage to say anything.
Well, it's interesting. I think that's a theme that runs across most of the stories we've all read and heard. Cass, what was your experience in the Pentagon like with that? Because I do think, you know, over the decades, we've had a lot of sensational stories about the armed forces and sexual abuse. What we're now seeing in the media and with some of the other stories is that at very high levels, right? These people were getting promoted even when it was an open secret.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just say, like, Lauren, I started at the Pentagon. I was 23 when I started at the Pentagon. And the three strikes you have against you when you come in when you're not prior military is you don't have that operational experience. You're young, which in the Pentagon is itself deadly because most of the people you're working with are at the ultimate or penultimate portion of their career, say 20 years in. And you're a woman. And I found in the early years, it was actually being young and not having the technical expertise, if you will, the operational expertise, that I thought was the most challenging. But looking back now, 25 or so years later, I'm more in the Evelyn camp, it's remarkable to me how much you could fix those. You got older. Nature takes its course. You gain technical expertise in any field you're in, and certainly in national security, and you can earn respect for that. But I'm not changing my gender. I mean, some people may choose to. That is not the choice I have made. So as I have gotten further in my career and look back, I think I would reweight those. And many women in these circumstances, in this community, and particularly in a place like the Pentagon, they are the only woman often in their entire workspace. It's a mix of civilian men, military men, political men. That's a very daunting environment in which to bring forward complaints. And you're trying to succeed and you're trying to get older and get that technical expertise and prove yourself. I think it's the same, if you will, for women in the military. They're often quite alone. That's why there's so much emphasis on building a cadre. I think that's vital on the civilian side. It's vital in the military. And I think the two are linked. I think we talk on the civilian side much too little about how our fates as women in national security are ultimately tied to the women in uniform and their ability to advance. Because when they are at the top, when they are respected for their warrior capabilities, I think that's when we can really start being respected as civilian women. I think we're always going to be hampered until we reach that point.
Did you experience it as a sexualized workplace?
I did in the modest ways. I think probably as Lauren's saying, I certainly as a leader later in the Pentagon, absolutely all the time women came to me, all the time. One of my number one rules for management to this day is always have a box of tissues. And it was well used, sadly. Typically it was not always, but typically it was along the sexism side. I did indeed have to oversee some issues relating to sexual assault allegations. And, you know, things progress pretty much as you expect, which is an all-male workplace with a woman who makes a complaint. A lot of disbelief that that's going on, a lot of explaining away the circumstances. And as a woman leader now, in a largely male-dominated, I have the same issue, which is I have to lead that organization in a way that's understandable, that's appropriate to the defendant, if you will, appropriate to the claimant, but also that can be understood in the larger culture of the workplace, so you can shift that workplace. Maybe you can do that radically in some cases. I found in the Pentagon you could do it best by charting a very careful course to demonstrate that there's support there for the claimant, but you know, to do it in a way that people understand is objective and is not about reinforcing a stereotype of women supporting women for the sake of that.
Right. Well, and that, you know, this goes to Lauren's point, I think, and this would be a good for you to come in, Laura. It goes to Lauren's point about how women have taken upon themselves, or that they often adjust their own behavior. And I feel like, you know, you and I talked about this, that that is certainly one of the natural responses probably most of us have had. Like, well, I'll change what I'm wearing or how I deal with this person or avoid this person.
Yeah, I'll wear more pantsuits or I'll wear baggier tops. You know, as if somehow I was having a conversation with a friend about this the other day, and she used the terms, you know, we androgynize ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's men don't have to do that. That does not happen. That is something that from its core, you know, you asked to Kath about, you know, did she find the Pentagon to be a sexualized workplace? I mean, my experience as I've been going back and thinking through so much of this in general is that this idea that women are somehow sexualized bodies first and people second is kind of underpinning all of this, whether it's sexism, whether it's harassment, whether it's abuse. We have to do things, especially at young ages, to make ourselves, at least I will just speak personally, you know I did things to make myself seem less attractive in the workplace. And that is a very odd thing to do. And other women make other choices and do different things. But looking back, I'm like that, you know, as you said, Susan, once you hit a certain age, you start to either have the confidence or the seniority or just you're just seeing differently. You can worry about that less. But I do think that sense that women have to somehow change our behavior is a really, you know, troubling element of this that is something that needs to be unpacked. And I think it also relates, not to jump topics, but we've seen some commentary about, well, the solution is just, you know, no supervisor should ever, of the opposite sex, should ever be in a room alone.
Not ahead, not in here.
With a closed door, et cetera. And that assumes that somehow, like, men simply can't control themselves around women, or that, you know, that it basically legitimizes the idea in a way that we can be, it's okay to see us as sexualized bodies, right? And
right.
And no, like, I want to be seen as a person.
Right. And that's, I think, what I've heard from everybody here is that's one of our great fears, in fact, about this national conversation that we're having, is that somehow it will lead to a form of backlash in which men are simply avoiding women in certain workplace contexts or certain professional contexts in order not to become a subject of allegations, and that could end up ultimately reinforcing rather than helping women or empowering them. But let's go back to your point, because it's a really important point. Step one of how women learn in the workplace that they're a minority and that they're treated differently is maybe what we're learning is what happens when you're young, mm-hmm. and you choose to take it upon yourself, right, to modify your own behavior. You did that because you were worried about specific men in your office, not because you didn't like to dress however you like to dress, right?
Yeah, I did it. I mean, I was 24 when I entered the State Department, and, you know, I was so similarly young, trying to look older. I've always looked even younger than my age, so that's a struggle. You're dealing with foreign officials who, in some cases, may not be used to encountering women in those kinds of positions as well. So I think that somehow in our minds, we've, at least at that point in my life, I had combined this idea of looking older with also not looking somehow you know, like a woman. I think over time that was, it was reinforced by experiences of, you know, a senior official commenting on how it was nice for him to think about me in a bikini when I was going away on vacation. Or, you know, another senior person who I got really good at the head squirm so he couldn't succeed in kissing me on the lips. And, you know, those kinds of experiences do then continue to fortify. It's like, well, did he think that was okay because of what I was wearing? It's all this continuum of, you know, somehow did we do something to, in fact, invite this behavior? And the reality is no. And I think for me, too, it was also that question of I used to somehow compartmentalize these things by saying, you know, it didn't cross that physical line. So am I going to, you know, rattle the cage, as Lauren was talking about, of, you know, having to trigger all of these things that would be involved in trying to report something? And what would the odds of something that was just a comment, you know, or just something that, you know, could be explained away in theory? What did that mean? How did I treat that? And so my instinct was always just to ignore it and push it to some recess of my brain.
Well, that's what I'm struck by, is how, you know, again, for our listeners, there's a lot of head nodding around the table. So you came from Capitol Hill at this age, which we all know has a specific problem. How does the Capitol Hill problem merge or differ from the national security world problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like Kath, being a someone who's never served in the military and working on national security issues, you walk into any given room with the assumption that you don't know what you're talking about. And look, I started as a professional staff member on the Armed Services Committee at 23, so everyone just assumed that I was there to get coffee. And so, you know, you bring your briefing back to the library to sit down and they say, can I get a cup of coffee, please? And you turn to them and say, well, we can start the briefing whenever you're ready. I'm ready. And then it just sort of, it puts everything in a really bad footing. But, you know, the political environment is really tough because, you know, you add on to this the chauvinism of the military, and then you talk about the chauvinism of politics, and you're sort of getting it on all sides. You're getting it from, right, the chairman of the committee who corners you at a reception and talks to you about his sexual endurance. And, you know, you get it when you drop off tables at one of your colleagues' desks and his desk faces yours and you look up at a screen and it's like there's porn on it. And like, you know, do you say something? Do you not say something? It's just, it's like, because it's not really like it's that helpful that something good is going to come out of it. So I think it's like, it's a really hard environment. And I think especially when you're young, like I started on the Hill during the time of the Clinton impeachment scandals. And so the number of senior men in national security who really wanted to have long conversations with me about the Starr report and what the president did with his cigar and what would I do if I had a dress that had a stain on it. And it's just like you just feel so creeped out by it. And a friend of mine talked about this in the context of a more recent scandal. Like, what do you do when someone's talking to you about the news, but it also feels like an HR violation? Like, it's sort of, you're stuck in this really awkward place. I mean, you can't really be like, well, it, you know, it's not of national importance, but you really don't want to be talking about it with anyone.
That is an excellent point about the Lewinsky scandal. This is maybe not realized by our younger millennial colleagues, but try dealing with that in a workplace situation. Evelyn, you've been nodding your head a lot about, you know, the connection between the world of institutionalized discrimination that we have, you know, that still exists, and how it relates to, you know, young women in the Pentagon or in a workplace where they're not they're outnumbered in such a vast way. They're seen clearly even today in a very specific way.
I mean, I think my situation was different because when I came here, I was almost 30 and I went into a senior role. Mind you, I was one of two women on a faculty of about, so I went to teach at the Marine Corps Command and Staff College. It was around the time of the Lewinsky scandal, so it was, when did I come down, 97. And I was one of two women. We were hired specifically so that they would have women on the faculty. I dressed in olive, beige, black, gray, you know. I mean, I put my hair up, and I also have always looked young for my age, which is getting to be an advantage. But but because people think I won't retire when I'm supposed to, maybe. But you know, when I was younger, it wasn't good. But I didn't have that same level of, you know, people weren't going to make passes at me because I was the professor. I would actually close the door sometimes because we were living in that post-tailhook environment where men were actually very afraid to deal with women. And so I purposely was sending a signal to the men, I'm not afraid of being alone in a room with you. And granted, it was easy because I was the more powerful one in every situation, except if I was dealing with the head of the university, and he probably didn't close his door because it was post-tailhook. So my situation was different because all of the stuff that happened, the situations I was in was when I was younger. I was in civilian environments. I was overseas. I did tell you one story where when I was sexually harassed, it was literally somebody grabbing my hand. So it wasn't so overt as if, you know, grabbing another part of my body, but the jarring sensation, like this person wanted to take a professional engagement, encounter, a dinner, and all of a sudden make it into something else when I was 21 years old, you know, and wasn't expecting it, was so shocking. I never forgot it to this day. But getting back to your question, I mean, I think the thing that I worried about then, because again, in this post-tailhook environment where there was so much sensitivity about how do you deal with women, how do you work with them, how do you talk to them, what's appropriate, what's not. I mean, I found myself telling Monica Lewinsky jokes because I could, you know, they were not disgusting, but they had more to do with the international reaction to the scandal. So it was more stereotypes about international norms about affairs. But, you know, I think what I worried about then and what I worry about now is that people get confused between sexual harassment in the workplace, so where there's a real power thing going on, then sexual harassment, you know, where it's peer-to-peer or maybe not. I mean, there might be a power thing going on. It's just abuse. And then the third bucket, which is the bigger one, which is sexism. And so I worry about how talking about the harassment might exacerbate the sexism. And to give you an example, the one I think I gave you before, when we were on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, Mika and I, there were members who either overtly or didn't say it, but they had policies where they did not travel with women. Even if those women happened to be the staff director of a senior committee, so I'm not going to name names, but you know, there were people whose careers were affected because they were the most senior woman on a committee, and their chairman or ranking member, or actually in this case it was a different member, so I want to make sure if anybody reads between lines that it's not one particular person, but that other members would say, I'm not traveling, even if that's the expert, I'm not traveling with that person because it's a woman, and the perception that maybe I'm having an affair with her, that hurt her career. So it gets back to what Laura was saying earlier about, you know, all of a sudden now you're going to have to, you know, put women off to the side. We want to be in the room. We want to be on the trips. So I think that would be one thing I would contribute to this.
The Pence rule, right? I mean, we have a vice president of the United States who won't have a meeting with a woman alone. Mm-hmm. So, Lauren, you're nodding your head. What, as you've watched these scandals unfold, what does it make you think about the nexus between the sexualized workplace and the sexism?
So one thing that I have worried a lot about over the past several months is to the extent that I am going to become that girl for always being the person who talks about, you know, sexism against women or sexual harassment in the workplace, on top of having a profile of talking about national security issues. And I have been, in fact, told by multiple people who I otherwise respect, like, why don't you just tone it down a little bit? Like, this is getting a little out of hand. Maybe you should focus more on substantive issues.
You mean than being a feminist, like sort of a public feminist.
Exactly. So, like, if you want to be taken seriously as a national security analyst, focus on national security. This whole feminism thing isn't really doing it for you. And I have... I definitely.
It's amazing you've actually had somebody say that because
absolutely.
I feel like
usually they don't say it.
It's self-censorship.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I have definitely took that to heart. Of wow, is this real? I've done a lot of examination. Like, how much am I focusing on this? Then I realized I don't care. This is my day-to-day life. I can't be a national security expert in a world where sexism and sexual harassment exist without being candid about that in some ways. And yes, perhaps there are a time and a place for when things are going to be most relevant and most impactful. But I have been just shocked by people who are saying, like, isn't that issue really taken care of? Isn't that really something that, you know, you have maternity leave and you have a great job and, like, you got promoted so many times. Isn't this really okay now?
So people have actually said that to you directly.
Outright. Yes. We have had so Julie and I launched a program at Center for New American Security wanting to talk more about women in national security. And as we launched it, we had senior people that we respect and really have worked closely with before tell us, this is not actually something that's interesting. We've already taken care of this issue. Women have advanced appropriately in national security, and you're fine. So could you move on and talk about something more relevant? Which is why we then launched a podcast series talking to women directly about what's it like to be a woman in national security, all of whom said, this guy's full of crap. So that's been a fun experience.
And just to add on to that, so one response is, why are you doing this? Problem solved. The other response has been by men in my age group, it's not solved yet, but it will be, so you can just let it go. Mm-hmm. So there's this sense, I've had more than one guy approach me to say, the trend lines are pointed in the right mm-hmm. direction. So think about where we were 20 years ago. Think of how far you're going to come in 20 years. And so you guys can sit back, focus on your substance, and not kind of worry your pretty little head about it. You know, there's men of a certain age where you think to yourself, that didn't cross a line. I was not physically accosted, but that was an inappropriate comment. And so, but you're 75. And so my choice at this cocktail or this event or this conference overseas is to walk away or laugh with my girlfriends in the corner or be a little ticked off and take a run later and burn off some steam, file it away for a funny story later. But those are kind of the choices. Or do I make a real stink? Do I push back? Do I challenge them in the moment? And then, you know, God knows what comes as a result of that. But so that was one piece of it, is what do you do with those guys of another generation that did come up through the field of national security where there were almost no women, you know, 50 years ago, whatever. Then there's in my own mind, there's been this, oh, well, it is different with men that are in their 40s or 50s, and we should have different expectations. And I have had this assumption that it's got to be better. And I think it is better in many cases. But I've also come to learn with the launch of this new project at CNAS that, my goodness, we have a lot of work to do. There are too many men out there in their 30s and 40s that believe that this is a wrap. We don't have a lot of work to do in this space. And that's been the shock for me in the last couple of months, truly.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more Women Rule. But first, a word from our presenting sponsor, Chevron. When more girls go into science, technology, engineering, and math, the whole world benefits. With the support of families, schools, policymakers, and businesses, girls can do remarkable things with STEM. Chevron is proud to join Women Rule in empowering the next generation of female leaders.
Kath, you were nodding your head vigorously here.
Yeah, I just this is all too familiar. And as Julie said, we've talked about this very frequently. But it's completely not fair. It makes me think of Secretary Clinton's experience with The Voice in the debates. And, you know, it's not fair, and yet it is. I think that is a real paradox that women in every industry are dealing with, which is, I think Julie put it beautifully, sometimes, you know, you make a decision to act on that. It's a judgment call. And press on the issues that you think are truly problematic. And sometimes you do let things go because you want people to focus on your credibility and what you have to say. And in the Clinton example, you modulate your vote. You end up modulating your voice, even though it's a ridiculous and completely sexist frame, right, that you've been put in.
I was going to say, you know, I think a lot about progress because I started my career with Pat Schroeder, and just after Tailhook. She was a real champion for women in combat and trying to get women into that warrior class because of what Kath was talking about. Like, if people don't see women as able to defend the country and as guardians of the country, they don't really think of us as truly able to secure the country and serious in national security. But one of the things that I dealt with early on in my career was the sexual assaults in the Aberdeen Proving Ground. There was an advanced training there, and women had been sexually assaulted by their drill instructors. And we did this whole series of investigations on it. And the institutional response at that time was,
Well, the problem is that we have men and women training together. And so if we just get the women out of basic training and segregate by gender, then this will all be fine. And it was this idea that the men can't help themselves. If the women are there, they're just going to want to rape them. And, like, that was the response, and that was the response we fought, and we actually won that fight, mostly. And so then you fast forward 20 years to a more recent round of sexual assault of women in the military that Kirsten Gillibrand took up and was, like, really hitting the Pentagon on their response to sexual assault. And at that moment, the response was, these are serious violent crimes against women, and you're not doing enough about them. And the institutional response is, we're not doing enough about them, and these are violent crimes. So, like, if you view progress as sexual assault was something that definitely was going to happen when you put men and women together to sexual assault is a violent crime against a person, that's progress. But, like, just acknowledging sexual assault as a crime doesn't get you all the way to, hey, we don't really feel like we need to include women's voices in the room. Hey, when we go out and play golf among the guys or, you know, have poker night and we talk about all these things, we're not going to include women in that. It doesn't get to a conversation that I had with a male colleague once, which says, you know, I really hate that you guys really push us on having women on panels because I really feel like we're lowering the standard of the panel in order to get a woman on there.
Oh, my God.
And I looked at him and I was like, you've never invited me to speak on a panel. And he looked at me like, you're proving my point. I'm like, this, right? Like, but, like, oh, we have this challenge all the time. And, like, okay, it's not as big an imposition that you don't have women's representation on panels. But, like, when I look around this room and I think about the expertise of women, I feel like you're actually really working hard to exclude the right voices from the room when you don't just naturally try and find a good person and you wind up with women on the panel. Yeah. And so, you know, great, I'm not, you know, raped in the workplace. But I also feel like there's something really missing on the sexism side of it.
Well, thank you for bringing that up because we all know our conversation always connects between these things and that in some way, right, it's obviously a good thing for society to recognize sexual assault as a crime, whether it occurs – wherever it occurs. But I'm listening to what everybody here – basically every single person at this table more or less has described or certainly has had incidences that would fit the textbook definition of some version of harassment in the workplace. No one here has described an assault, you know, but we've all described varying moments where we felt uncomfortable or, you know otherwise sexualized in a way that was inappropriate for the professional circumstance. We've all separately described, you know, the institutional barriers to women that have existed in all of these workplaces. And that's what leaves me still feeling uncomfortable around the if it's just the sort of assault piece of it, you know. And by the way, you said it's progress, but Evelyn's point and also, you know, Lauren Cass' point is the outcome of this national conversation isn't necessarily to make things better for women in the workplace, or that's a concern that almost everybody has expressed in some way here. But Laura, I wanted to go back to you when we were talking about this point about how women respond, right? You know, and this idea that, you know, whether it's Hillary Clinton's voice or what happens when we encounter these issues now.
Yeah, for me, I think it's been an evolution. The conversations, the national conversations, have sort of forced me to reckon with some of these things. I think I'm still a single woman, which has meant having to do a little bit less of the balancing and face some of it brings a different set of challenges, let me put it that way. But I think it also means I've been able for a longer period of time to kind of continue this facade in my head that somehow being a woman in national security hasn't been that big of a deal. Like, I've often said that being one of the, like, the when people ask me, like, what's the biggest thing about being a woman in national security, my answer is often the remarkable thing is that it's unremarkable. Like, if you do your job and you work hard, and I think I kind of, like, sold myself this story, and part of me really does believe that, except I've forgotten or compartmentalized or just had to plow through all of the crap that no man ever has to deal with in order to just do your job, right? So what we were talking about earlier, how thinking about just the very fact in the morning of how do I dress so as not to be seen in a certain light, right? Or, you know, how do I avoid that particular person or getting alone in the room with them when I might not want to? Or, you know, any of those kinds of things. I mean, those are barriers that, you know, women uniquely face. I mean, I do actually want to footnote here that there are men who have been, you know, who have been and can be, are harassed, and that's equally as problematic. But by and large, this is something that women face across the board much more significantly. And I think that, you know, I've been trying to understand. I mean, I was a women's studies major, like, I've always been a strong feminist. So, like, how have I kind of forced myself to, like, forget about all this stuff or somehow make myself think it was okay? And I think the reality is that then the power structures that we face, I mean, it goes back to this sexism point and the institutional pieces of it. You know, we are so disincentivized to rock the boat or to draw attention to the fact that we're women. So, yeah, to Lauren's point, right? I mean, you basically just want to be good at your job and work your way up and not rock the boat and not try to make somebody think you're trying to be different or special or be granted some kind of, you know, different kind of, you know, accord. And I think that then means that we deal with all this stuff that nobody should ever have to deal with. And so I've done the same thing as Lauren, going back to my 24, 25-year-old self and thinking, how could I have just let that go? Like, how could I have, and then actually really forgotten about it for 10 years, right? Like, really tried to put it to a place where I just never had to think about it, because the reality is most of those men are people I still had to deal with and who, in fact, my career often depended upon in one way or another.
Kathy.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, you know, maybe this is a very depressing point, but and it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
You know, when you lead men and women, and I have many great men, for instance, who work for me or have worked for me, you still face it.
Yeah.
If I say a workplace needs to be kept professionally, somebody might make a mom joke, right? They would say that to a Marine who tells their Marines to keep it clean, right? Those kinds of things happen. People who comment in an inappropriate way on your attire, things like that. It still happens when you're a leader. Now you have, to Evelyn's point, more control, you have more say, you have more confidence in how you deal with that. And that makes a big difference. But I don't want people listening who are in their 20s to think this is a phase you pass through. What I was trying to say earlier is you kind of think it is a phase you pass through because many women are so hyper-competent and they're working so hard and they're getting the job done and they're recognized through staff levels up to a point. And then, you know, making it to that next level and being respected as a national leader, that's a whole other game. And it's not like the sexism goes away. It just sort of shifts how you feel it.
Right. And it might even be harder why are we having this conversation about national security or foreign policy? These are rarefied jobs. To get to the top, there have been a few women national security advisors and a couple of women secretaries of state. There's never been a woman secretary of defense. There's never been a woman in many of these key roles. And as you said, it's a whole different ballgame. So I want to get to the point about that as well. International trips, every single person said to me, listen, the thing that's different about being in national security and being in foreign policy is that we're not only dealing with the challenges of our unique culture here in Washington, we're going overseas where there's even fewer women.
For me, it's actually even more complicated because I'm even rarer. I'm a woman of color in national security. And so, like, I go abroad on international trips and no one expects that I'm actually an American. So, you know, like, I've been waiting in the lobby to, like, get the van to the embassy briefings and, like, everyone's looking around. This is in Asia. And everyone's looking around, like, trying to find me. And they're chasing after other Asian women in the lobby thinking that it's me because they can't actually tell the difference between us. I mean, like, it, you know, so it's just really hard. I've had meetings where I've been pressing people on sort of, where are your diversity numbers? Why are you not recruiting more people who look like our adversaries? And being told, well, the people that we work with want to work with someone who looks like an American. And I'm thinking, well, what do you think I look like? Because I'm an American. And so I think it's like a real challenge on overseas trips, right? They assume that you're the minder, the handler, the girl to get coffee. They don't think that you're there for a substantive role. There was a time early on in my career where I went out to Japan with a member of Congress on a CODEL, and he was spending a lot of time talking about, like, home porting and, like, you know, the fleet commander wasn't having any of it because he didn't really want to – he didn't care. And so he's going on. Finally, at the end of the briefing, we're getting ready to go, and the aide says, I'm sorry, Admiral, but, you know, she's the professional staff member on the Armed Services Committee who does military personnel. And he says, oh, my goodness, I have so many things that I want to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about pilot retention bonuses. I want to talk to you about readiness, and I want to talk to you about all these other things. And I said, I'm sorry, but we have to catch a plane. He said, I thought you were the translator. Well, like, this is a meeting between Americans. We just happen to be in Japan, and I have an Asian face. So, like, why did you think I was the translator? Like, that's bad staff work on his end. But it's also, like, it goes to this very deep construction in his head of what the professional staff member who handles military personnel should look like. And this sort of mental construction of a stereotype of a national security person as a big, brawny, older white man really inhibits you, because you then have to begin to prove that you are the woman who knows what you're talking about and you're the one that they actually have to be meeting with. And it's just – it's a really hard place to start the meeting without that credibility and then to have to work to prove it over the course of the meeting.
Well, it's an excellent point, especially now that we live in this moment where we literally have a president who picks national security officials because he likes their look and that they, like, basically they fit the suit, right? You know, they're my generals. Evelyn.
I just wanted to jump in because – so I would go – I don't know if this would still happen. It probably still would happen today, again, getting back to my earlier point. But I would get off a plane, whether it was in the U.S. or overseas, and there'd be somebody standing there, usually a male, but also females, with a sign, Dr. Farkas. And they'd be, like, looking over me, beyond me, past me, left, right, you know, and here I am. Because they're looking for, like, Dr. Farkas is supposed to be a 6-year-old male guy with white hair.
I have shared repeatedly my experience with foreign officials, especially from countries where women are even less prominent than they are in the United States in national security jobs, where I would get these remarks, like, over and over and over again. It took me a while to figure it out, but it was, you know, it was always something along the lines of, wow, like, when I would meet my counterparts, wow, you're in this position, and you're a woman. And sometimes, oh, and you're so young, you must be so smart. As if I had to overcome my womanhood with some exceptional qualifications or something in order to have possibly gotten into this position. But the corollary to that is that my experience was, and I think some of this has to do with the hierarchical nature of foreign policy and diplomacy, is that at the end of the day, my counterparts, after getting over that initial, like, trying to wrap their heads around the cognitive dissonance that a woman was in that job, they actually dealt with me based on the title, based on the position. And, yeah, sometimes there was some, you know, oddities about it. But for the most part, that was my experience.
But although I will say that, like, on the Russia stuff, I would say I've always felt that gender, you know, a lot of people have talked about Vladimir Putin's dislike of Hillary Clinton as being specific. But you know that Putin also did not get along with Condi Rice. And mm-hmm. Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, you know, had a famously contentious relationship with both of them that differed significantly from how he interacted with John Kerry.
Or Merkel. You know, yeah. other mm-hmm. women that have come through. I mean, but I think Laura's right that it can be interesting, and I think you're relieved sometimes when you see how they quickly foreign delegations can adjust. But they also base their reactions on the cues they're getting from your colleagues. And I've experienced the opposite, where my colleagues don't see it, or they don't stand up for it, or they don't react. I've certainly had positive experiences where someone literally came up to me and said, you're going to really enjoy the spouses program. And I said, I'm not here with my spouse. I'm not married to anyone on this delegation. And I'm presenting. And colleagues didn't pick up and come in to support. In other instances, they have to say, hey, silly person from country X, you know, that's not right. And, you know, you should know Julie's not pouring coffee. She's the one. But, you know, and so you do sometimes have folks come to your defense and try to kind of right set the conversation. But certainly there have been many instances where it's just their antennas down, they're focused on something else, they're as tired as you are, and you're stuck in this set of circumstances where the foreign delegation is not going to take you seriously. You're also stuck with all sorts of added challenges that come with international travel, awkward moments in hotel lobbies or in a hotel hallway, drinking, you're out late, you know, there are other where inappropriate behavior surfaces either by your own team, people you're with, or by other guests at the event or by a foreign delegation. And so it presents real challenges. For as many challenges that we have here in the United States, I have found, and like Evelyn, I've worked overseas for many years, some of my worst experiences actually have been overseas, where I have had physical incidents where people have grabbed me by the arm or closed the door and tried to, you know, strong arm me. That has not happened in the United States. So I do, for my own personal experience, I do feel like being abroad does present unique challenges that are different.
Lauren.
So when Julie and I did a survey for Women in National Security earlier this year, one of the responses that we got back from women, I would say probably a third to half of the respondents, talked about a moment where they were overseas or meeting with a foreign delegation, and they had walked into the room and somebody there assumed that they were the person to get coffee. And it came up so often that it made me feel as though it was an archetypal dream, you know, where we all dream that we forgot to study for a major exam in some way. The fact that this has happened to so many of them, first of all, it made me realize I've never walked into a room and asked somebody to get me coffee because I assumed that was their job. Secondly, that it made me recall the one time I actually was in a room to get coffee for somebody, and a four-star general came to me and said, "Did you write that memo? That memo was incredible. Thank you so much." And I had not written the memo. I was just there purely to get coffee. And I will – to my dying day, I will think that he is a wonderful person, even though he's done many other things in life that were somewhat sketchy. But based on that, we'll just follow him to the ends of the earth. But that the moment that, you know, the soul crushing moment of like, oh, you must be just here to get coffee, that has happened so many of us. Why does that happen so often? That is so strange that you would walk in and assume somebody's there to give you coffee.
For many years, I refused to learn how to make coffee so that I could say to people, I don't know how to make coffee and I'm not going to do it.
That's awesome. Kath, I know you wanted to jump in. I thought I wanted to share a story, though, that's relevant to this about the international component of, you know, being a foreign correspondent, a war correspondent, because it is relevant, again, to this question that we're all grappling with of, where does the – we know it's a spectrum, but where's the spectrum between our gender defining us in our professional lives and, you know, actually being under threat at some point in a way that's specific to being a woman? I had very little experience as a war correspondent. I went to Moscow to – you know, I studied Russian, you know, the history. You know, it's primarily a political story in Moscow. And then September 11th happened. And so – I, along with my husband, we spent about 9 months in and out of Afghanistan after September 11th, definitely not something that we were prepared for in any way. And I had one guy who was the ruler of Jalalabad, the guy who led the Battle of Tora Bora. He really liked me. He was interested in me being his fourth wife. But luckily, you know, my translator explained that my husband was also in Afghanistan, if not right there, and that we were a famous love match. But, you know, I say this because it really – there were the two sides of being such an outlier, such a minority, you know, that you literally defy the categories. And that, to me, is why are we having this conversation? I know I could – convene a group of smart professional women in almost any field and here in Washington, and we could have some of the same conversations, but not all of them. Whether it's talking about the definition of what is a guardian, you know, what is our notion of national security, whether it's talking about some of the politics of it, whether it's talking about these unique institutions, you know, of civilians in our Pentagon or in our National Security Council, right? So just to drill into that, but I do think this experience that we've all had of working overseas and representing some U.S. institution, whether it's the Washington Post or it's, you know, the State Department, is unusual. The other thing I wanted to get at before we end, and you guys are so generous with time, but is this question of representations of women in the media and the notion of authority, which very much goes to authority and expertise. In our Washington policy world, especially when you're talking about ascending the ladder, as Kath pointed out, to leadership positions, that becomes ever more important. Many of these scandals are related to the media right now. And I just want to get everybody's view about the portrayals of women. I've seen many, if not all of you on TV, you know, looking gorgeous and saying really smart things. We've talked about panels and mantles the amazing, often lack of representation. Do you guys think that the sexualized image of women on television, even talking about, you know, politics, the White House, and foreign policy, affects what we do?
I'll jump in. Yes, I do. And I think the thing that I notice more than anything is if you look for the hard, truly hard security end, it's retired male military, always. If you need, you know, what's the cruise missile attack implications, right, it's going to be retired Lieutenant Colonel so-and-so.
Because it fits our
special
image.
Operator, because it fits what the audience, they think at least the audience wants to see. I live for the day when even, you know, I'll accept the military piece, but that there's a woman up there who is being asked to explain what the troop movements mean, what Zapad, the implications of Zapad mean for, you know, defense of the Baltic in detail. That's an area where I see sort of a hard line we haven't been able to cross yet.
And if I could two finger on that, because I work for NBC, and they actually, to their credit, recognize that they have the same faces, these retired four-star male men who haven't served in a long time. I've said to NBC that they should get more people, but the problem is that they want, so it gets back to, I think, what you started with, Kath, about getting four-star, you know, getting women in the military up to the highest ranks. I've been able to send a couple of names. I say, well, wait for, you know, some to retire because we have a couple now at the peak, but there aren't enough. So I think that is actually, I mean, in some cases, you have to admit, there aren't enough if you want a military person to speak to operational issues.
So can I just one quick thing back to your Laura's earlier comment about how we self-select and how our appearance, you know, we focus on let's dress down, let's not make our appearance part of the issue, I'll wear the black suit, button up the jacket, pull my hair back. The bizarre thing is when we go to the studio, we do the exact opposite thing. And it's either on our own accord, we're like, oh, I want to look nice, right? Or we're encouraged by the people there. I mean, I have walked in with my hair back and they're like, sister, uh-uh, there's no way you're getting away with that. Like, that's just horrible. We don't do hair pulled back. And they've literally yelled down the hall, like, hair, we need someone to help with our hair. Like, it's so bad. You know, and the makeup lady's standing there like, I can only do so much. You know, and it is. It's this whole shebang. You know, you're committed for an hour. You show up well in advance. They're going to pick and, you know, do all sorts of stuff with you for a while. You sit, you wait. It can be, you know, a major commitment. I see my male counterpart, somebody I know and work with, stroll in, get a little pat down. They go right on. They get back in the car, leave. It's a totally different commitment for them in terms of time. These types of things, you know, again, I hate this whole conversation is hard because, as we've talked about, we don't want to complain. We are all grateful for the opportunities we've had. I don't want to be that person. Like, poor me, I've succeeded in my career. That's not the point. The point is to highlight for young women coming up and also for our male colleagues. I'm sorry, guys, there's just a different world that we live in. Most of the time we roll our eyes, we chuckle, we laugh, we cope with it. But it's worth acknowledging. And this appearance thing brings it right to a head for me.
So I couldn't agree more with everything that Julie just said about the whole makeup experience. I don't have a contract, so I have the luxury of doing a bunch of different networks, and they do the makeup and hair differently. And so
the BBC.
So I did, yes,
nothing.
No, yeah, BBC is like almost nothing. And then there's a range, and then you go all the way to Fox, where I feel like a baby doll, and the fake eyelashes,
they put the fake
curls, and the bright pink lipstick,
and American Gypsy Bride.
It's so uncomfortable, but they also give you no say, really. I mean, I have found it very difficult, speaking of power dynamics, you know, it's very difficult to actually say, wait, I don't want to look like that. And I've now drawn the line at fake eyelashes and the baby doll hair, but it's a really interesting thing because they are clearly presenting a very particular image to their very particular audiences, that are tuning in to watch. I also had one experience that I will share of being in the green room after getting all dolled up with a male colleague who strolled in much later, got the, you know, exactly as Julie just described. And we were sitting there just chatting as we would. This is somebody I work with closely on a regular basis. And he kept getting, like, distracted. He had to stop himself and literally was like, I'm sorry. I'm just so distracted by looking at you right now because you don't look like yourself. And I don't even know how to interact with you right now. He actually, like, verbalized this. It was interesting watching how uncomfortable he was with me being presented in this very,
in a caricature of sexuality.
He
changed. He's used to dealing with you as a colleague in a gender-neutral sense,
exactly.
And then you became a caricature of femininity.
Exactly.
Your Fox story reminds me of someone I know and many of you know well, who's like a much older, like a grandmother, expert, professor. And she told me a story of going to Fox and she wasn't really paying attention. And she gets in the chair and they put the fake eyelashes on her before she did it, like trying to turn like basically this sort of like grandmother into this. And I thought, you know, that's how you know there's a template and women have to fit in it. I went the other day to NBC studio and there's one guy there that I like a lot. And he thanked me for wearing a jacket as he's done before. And he said, you know, I always love it when you come in because, you know, you said that like it's like professional to wear a jacket. And I really feel that way. And he's like, it's much easier to mic you up. But, you know, I always felt like, you know, watching these shows, if you didn't know anything at all or you watch with the sound off, not only would you see that only very brawny large men identified as former generals were allowed to comment on any military action anywhere in the world. But you would also notice, like, why is that woman wearing a cocktail dress at 6 o'clock in the morning? You know, and all the men are wearing suits. And I always felt like the message, you know, just in a very reductionist, like visual way is very clear, which is, you know, these women are there for a different reason than the men are there. And yet it's very hard because you want to look nice or, you know, put your...
The contribution I can make to this conversation is that, so my name is spelled L-O-R-E-N, which is a name that quite frequently men have as well. Not always, but particularly overseas. And I occasionally get asked to either write things or be on the radio or show up to a panel. And it is extremely clear the moment that they realize she's a woman. Oh, okay. Different set of questions, different set of the way we're going to treat you. I do read the comment section sometimes when I publish something, and the people who assume that I'm a woman say very different things than the people who assume it was a male writer, particularly for whatever reason they assume that I had been a male person in the military. So those moments are always just remarkable to understand that, like, yes, you are truly treated differently based on what people think you're a man or a woman. And when I've had people interact with me on Twitter who for months at a time think that I'm male and have been kind of joshing with me and swearing and being kind of funny and then have come back and apologized saying, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize you're a woman. Like, how do you think this is actually an okay conversation to have? Like, are you not having a moment of thinking, maybe I shouldn't actually care if you're a man or a woman based on how I'm treating you?
Yeah, I want to say something also about the men who are mentors and who are mentees. I mean, you know, people are leaders at every level, men or women. And so all of us, I'm sure, have had experiences where male colleagues or male bosses have really made a difference by not just being observers who sat to the side, but by intervening in a positive way. And for any man who's actually made it this far in the podcast, first, thank you. And second, you know, please do that.
Both of you.
And then for anyone who feels that they have been discriminated against, that they've been harassed, we are definitely a strong community. We're a community that talks and that helps. And so please reach out and talk to people if you need help, because there is a network out there. It's bipartisan. Because obviously there are women Republicans in national security who experience these same things. And it's at every level. So just know that you're part of a broader community and we are here to help.
Well, I want to thank everybody for sharing so generously, not only of your time, but of your wisdom. And this has been a really, I think, powerful conversation. I'm struck by something that Julie said as we close up, which is that for anybody listening to this, in some ways, it suggests that women have experienced an alternate
reality. And I hope that there are some men who live in our world who have, you know, been in national security, who are foreign policy experts, who take the time to listen to this and to realize my guess is that it feels very foreign to them, that this is an alternate narrative of the workplace and of the career path that you all are describing, that really is just very different from the kinds of issues that they worry about at every step of their career. And the fact that there's so much wisdom around this table that also has to do with the Iran deal and Russia and the Mideast and weapon systems and, you know, procurement, a subject for many, many other conversations. But I feel that what we have all done is wrap our heads around together, you know, a national conversation. That's an important conversation. We don't know what will come out of it. But everyone here has stepped up, as Mika said, and, you know, has already identified herself as part of, you know, a national discourse about the things that we care about. And so obviously this is something that we all care about. So I thank you for that. And I thank everyone for listening to the Global Politico.